Good afternoon. So last time we talked about how devices work. So we had our kernel level interface, which we saw was basically the file interface with a special case for what we call block devices, which work with the page cache, where we never actually want to like read single bytes. We want to read whole pages in or write whole pages out, because that's what the page cache does. We talk about, well, we have that high-level interface. What are the device drivers that implement that interface, that know how to communicate with a sound card or the monitor, actually do? And we learn that the devices are connected on something like the memory bus and present themselves as basically magical memory. You access the memory with loads and stores, and it actually ends up doing something to the device, reading, writing, etc., clearing buffers, as defined by whatever the device controller thought was a useful interface. And we had two parts of our device drivers. We have the part that's called from the system call, whose main job is to service that system call. It looks in typically buffers for data that's waiting to go out onto the device or that came in from the device. And sometimes it can service it directly from that. Otherwise, it queues something on the device if needed and then waits for the device to be ready. So we have the quote-unquote bottom half of the device driver, which happens from the interrupt handler. So when the device says, hey, I'm ready, I have data, or I finished the write, that part runs, and it can wake up a waiting process that's waiting on a read or write and handles these things that happen in response to when the device is ready to do something. As part of this, we talked about two strategies for sending data to and from devices. So we learned like this magic memory strategy, clearly very simple for controlling. Single load or store instruction does our control operations like, hey, start reading, start writing, change the screen resolution, and so on. But for communicating data, we can use that same type of interface, but it's kind of inefficient because the OS gets in this loop, talking to the memory. It doesn't really want the data on the device controller. It wants it in some buffers it has itself or in the user's memory. But we can do better than that by having the device controller talk to memory directly. It's on the memory bus. It can just send things to the memory. And so we have this alternate interface where instead of the OS actually reading from a buffer on the device says, rather than have my buffers be located internally, I'll use your main memory wherever the OS tells me is okay. And this is typically what we do when we have large data transfers like hard disks and network cards. We don't want to spend a lot of time copying things. We'll just have the device controller do it instead, hopefully while the OS is doing other useful stuff. So then we started talking about file systems, introducing with the FAT file system. So the FAT file system sees the disk as a series of what we call clusters, which are one or more of these sectors, which is the minimum unit we can read or write the disk in. And FAT, we needed to represent files, we need to know where its data is, and we just had a linked list of clusters, where that linked list was stored in the file allocation table, which is just an array, which for the purposes of finding files is an array of next pointers for that linked list. Also, I'm talking about directories. So we need to find files. We don't want to find them by the name of where their first cluster is. That's not a good file name. We want actual names. So we have directories, which are like files, but they contain a list of names and also the starting cluster numbers, and we saw some other metadata about the file. And by looking at these directories, that's how we look up a file given a name, like readme.txt. We look in directories to find readme.txt. If we want to find the first directory, we have a fixed pointer to it in the header of the disk. Okay, so questions about things we covered last time? Okay, so brief logistical note. So I released some paging checkpoint grades yesterday, and I updated them yesterday evening because I realized I tested things and didn't grade them correctly. So there were some slight, like 1 point downward adjustments for things that you might want to pay attention to on the second part of the assignment. like places where I erroneously said, yeah, you handled guard pages right and you didn't. And some cases where I tested for you handling fork with allocate on demand and didn't actually put it in the grade. I didn't want to give you the impression that, hey, that's all great for the final submission, when it wasn't. Is there any questions on this or paging checkpoint rating in general? Okay. So, this time when we were finishing up, we went through this, our FAT directory entries. We saw they had all these fields arranged in this kind of strange historical way. And we saw this representation here as a C structure, which, you know, is useful because we can just copy directly into this structure. And we learned that we have this header. So our header is where we find information about how big our clusters, how big is our file allocation table, learn about extra copies of the file allocation table, and it turns out a whole lot of other information. And every file system we'll look at is going to have something equivalent to this, some sort of well-known location data structure which says this is where the configuration of the file system, these are the sizes of things, and so on. This is a common feature we'll see on every single file system, pretty much. And usually they put it near the beginning of the disk, but that's not required. And like our directory entries, we're going to have a C struct represent the header, and by carefully writing our C struct and marking it as packed, we can have this be something we should copy from the disk into memory and access the fields and see, rather than writing code which is like get byte 5 because that's where the bytes per sector is. We can just access fields of this structure. And it has all the fields we saw before. We have the size of sectors. We have the reserve sector count, which tells you SAR, and so on. I also note we have information here about so we have the number of FATs, and we have flags indicating which of the FATs are actually in use. So I mentioned we have this backup copy of the file allocation table. Part of that scheme is that typically all those copies are used, but the file system has the option of only having one active at a time, so you can do things like resizing the FAT. Okay, so that's about the header. So now that we know where to find the root directory with the header, we know how to figure out how big are clusters and so on, let's talk about operations related to writing data to the disk. We talked about reading data, which is what you'll have to do for the homework, like what's in directories, how do I traverse directories, how do I find out where the data for a file is. But we also want to like create files. And there's some extra things we'll need for that. So we want to create a file. So our first step is we need to add a directory entry. In the easy case, well, there's going to be some extra space in the directory, which is one of those unused directory entries. The first byte indicates that it has no name or it's an empty entry. So we just fill that in. Then we need to choose where does the file go. We need to choose where it's its first cluster, where it's the second cluster if it's big enough. And then we need to update the FAT with that information. And one thing we haven't really discussed how to do here is how do we choose where to put the file? How can we know where it's okay to put the file? We need some extra information we don't have about like what clusters can we actually use. And the FAT file system uses the file allocation table to store this. So in addition to storing these next pointers for files, it also stores a list of what clusters are free. And the way it does this is it marks those with a special value. I'm using 0 in this example here, indicating that cluster is not used as part of any file. And they can use 0 because 0 is where the header is. You aren't going to put a file there, so you know it's not a real next pointer. Okay. And what you'll do when you're creating a file is you'll look through this, and you can choose however you want to take some free entries and say, this is where I'm putting the file. And notice here that, you know, probably maybe it made more sense to choose 5 and 7, but it's just as valid to choose 21, 22, and 24. So that's the file data. Then I have to update the directory. So the simple case I mentioned is that we have our directory's data in some cluster, and we look in it and we find an unused entry. We just have, you know, it's a whole cluster. We don't have a full cluster's worth of file names. So we just add, find an unused entry and replace it with our new file. So we say, no, this is not blank, this is new.txt, and it's a cluster 21. That's the good news. You might say, but what if the directory cluster here is full? Like it only has so many entries. We can make a big enough directory that that will happen. So what we do in that case is we'll need to allocate a second cluster for the directory, which we do the same way we allocated a second cluster for the file. We just find a free cluster, update the file allocation table for the directory to point to it, and we write that the new directory entry there, and we also need to fill in the rest of it, so we fill the rest of it in with these unused entries. Okay, so questions on this procedure here? Or, yeah.
Could you have two different things writing to the same clusters, and before they added to the directory, they like overwrite each other?
So the question is, can we have two different things trying to use the same free cluster and not realize it because, you know, they both say, I want cluster 7. The other one says, I want cluster 7. Then the first one then updates the FAT to do this. So it's the responsibility of the operating system implementing the file system to make sure that it knows what it's currently writing. And operating systems are going to have their own data structures to track things they haven't written to disk to avoid that problem. And we'll talk more about dealing with things like crashes, which you might be worried about later on. Because another part of that process is, what if we wrote some of the data, what's going to happen? And we'll talk more about that later on. That is a tricky question. But as far as if we haven't written anything about using the entry, well, the operating system needs to keep track of that internally. And a likely implementation would be, or at least a simple implementation for FAT, is that the operating system will have a copy of the FAT in memory, and it will update that immediately when it's anticipating using an entry. That would be one way to handle this. Okay, so other questions? Okay, so I talked about creating files. So there's another thing we might need to do, which is deleting files. And now that we know how we indicate empty space on the disk with these zero entries in our file allocation table, well, deleting a file is creating a bunch of those empty entries in the file allocation table, and also making sure the directory entry doesn't exist anymore by replacing it with one of those unused entries. So that's deleting files. Deleting directories is similar. You zero out the directories, FAT allocation, file allocation table entries, and its directory entry if it's not the root directory. But hopefully you aren't deleting the root directory, so it should have one. Okay. So that's, you know, everything we need to know to modify a FAT file system and to read it, except for the details of like exactly how things are laid out, which is why in the assignment that's coming up, we link you to the specification, which is thorough and possibly annoying to read. But it's definitely complete, if not written in the most logical order, but has all the information somewhere. So what do we think about FATs? Are there things that we're dissatisfied with from an efficiency point of view, or a flexibility point of view with FAT, or that we might want to, you know, fix? Things that are really good. Yeah.
I guess here
Okay, so wasting space. So you're saying you're wasting space because a file that uses like 10 bytes uses the whole cluster. Is that what you're complaining about?
That too, but like the end mark.
Okay, so I think there might be a misunderstanding of the end mark then. So you're assuming that the end mark is like an extra cluster we add to indicate there's nothing left in the file. We'll actually put the end mark on the last cluster with data in the file. That's a good question. It's good to clarify. So all the clusters in the list have data. The last one just has no next pointer, so it has the end mark, but it means it's still part of the file and still may contain data. But it might not use all the cluster. So parts of clusters unused. Okay? Yeah.
It could be potentially really unslow to like find whether there's a free spot somewhere if you're just like searching through the whole table to find the next free cluster.
Finding free space is linear time. Okay, anything else? There's some other things which are linear time, which maybe don't need to be. Yeah. Deleting a file is linear time. Seeking to byte X is linear time. If I want to get to the middle of a file, I have to scan the entire linked list to get to that. So that's maybe not great. Searching a directory is linear time. That's probably more obviously not great. Seeking to the middle of the file, we might say, you don't do that very often. We usually read the whole file. But certainly, looking for a particular thing in a directory, you do all the time. And, well, we have to read the whole directory to figure out if it's not there. That doesn't seem great if we have big directories. Yeah, so we'll talk about issues like this and ways of fixing them with different file system designs later. But first, an interlude into something about how hard drives actually work. And you might say, well, why are we going to talk about this? So I'm going to talk about how hard drives work, and their performance. So one complaint you might have is, hey, isn't the future SSDs? Why do we care about this anymore? So I'll talk about SSDs later. But I'm talking first about hard drives, because most of the file systems we're going to look at were initially designed with hard drives in mind. And they have particular attributes which are based on how hard drives work. The other reason is that SSDs, even though the underlying physical technology is very different than hard drives, they've taken a lot of effort to look like hard drives to the operating system, even though that's not how they work. Okay, so we're going to talk about hard drives. So, and also, like, it's still probably the most cost-effective way as far as long-term storage that you can access on demand on a cost per gigabyte basis. If we're talking offline, like backup storage, you can probably do better with tape at high volume. By high volume, I mean like you're in the petabytes range. But it's probably the most effective for storage that you can access on demand. So let's talk about what hard drives are. So this is the picture of an innards of a hard drive. And we have some components here. So the hard drive has these platters. These platters, there's actually a stack of them here that are hidden by this little thing. But there's a stack of these thin platters. And they store data magnetically. So they have a magnetic signal encoded in lots of little circles. I'll show you later, called tracks. And in the operation of the hard drive, these spin at some relatively high speed. How high depends on basically how much you pay for your hard drive and how much noise you would like it to make. So like somewhere between like 4,500 resolutions per minute and 15,000, depending on that. And while it's spinning, these arms, and you see there's a little stack of them here, get moved over the hard drive, and the head will read or write the magnetic signal that it's rotating above. And that is where the data is stored. Okay, so questions on the components here. So we're going to talk about this a little more abstractly from this point on. I'm not going to have pictures. Yeah. So there's multiple arms. Basically, so, or another way of looking at it is we have like one arm with multiple heads. Generally, these arms are all going to be locked together. They're not going to go to different parts of different platters. They're all going to go to the same place on all the platters. Yeah. So the question is data stored contiguously in what sense? So we're going to divide up these platters into pieces, and we're going to say that data stores on particular pieces. Because of the physical operation, you're talking about, like, does it go down or what? Well, we want to store related things, so, you know, vertically together, because we read and write those at the same time, like, just as a physical consequence of how this works. We also want to store related things so they're close together physically on the disk, because that determines how much time we have to wait for it to rotate or the heads to move to get to that. So other questions? Okay. So we're going to have names for the particular parts of it. So on these disks, we're going to say we have these platters, we have a bunch of heads that are sitting above the platters while the platters are rotating very, very fast. And these are sitting above some data that's stored on a disk. We're going to call the bunch of data that they're sitting over at any particular location a cylinder, because it kind of looks like a cylinder here. That's across all the platters. And the data on one of the platters in one of those circles we're going to call a track. And that track is going to have individual sectors on it, which traditionally, at least, I'm not sure if all hard drives work this way, would correspond to one of the sectors we would read from the operating system. I'm saying they correspond because the operating system is just giving sector numbers, and the hard drive has some flexibility as far as where it puts that data. But the traditional scheme is that it just assigns each sector to one of these little notches I show up here. And this physical layout is important for the operating system to know about because it affects how fast it can read two pieces of data on the hard drive together. So one thing we need to worry about is something called seek time. That if we want to read from one cylinder and then move to a different cylinder that's either closer to the center or further from the center on the disk, the head needs to move to that location. And the heads are not instantaneous. They are physical objects that need to move. So that takes some amount of time. And on a modern disk, it's like 5 to 10 milliseconds. And this is known as seek time. And obviously, if we're moving like less distance, that seek time is going to be lower. 5 to 10 is sort of like the one end to the other time for a typical disk. So we also have what we know as rotational latency, that the disk is rotating all the time, but if I want to read something here and then something that's on the other side of the disk, I need to wait for the disk to rotate. I need to wait for it to get there. I guess you know, I can't move the head to the other side of the disk. I need to wait for the disk to move, and it's just moving all the time. And that takes some amount of time. And how long it takes depends on how fast the disk rotates. And it's like 2 to 8 milliseconds. The reason for such a big range is that there's a big range of how fast disks rotate, because rotating faster means it takes more power, it fails more often, it makes more noise. There's a variety of speeds that you'll see out there, and that will affect that amount of time. And once we've actually moved the head to the right part of the disk and waited for the disk to get to the right part of the track that we actually want to read, we need to wait to actually transfer the data, and that depends on, again, the disk, depends on how dense it is, how fast it's rotating, but it's something like 50 to 100 megabytes a second for a good disk, for actually reading or writing data, once the head gets in the right place. And as an operating system, designing a file system, we can do things which will dramatically affect this seek time and rotational latency that we actually experience. We can't like get rid of the seek time or get rid of the rotational latency, but we can put things on the disk in a way where we're doing less moving the heads and waiting for the disk to rotate. And this is a big thing many file systems are going to try to do. And the big thing we see here is that we really want to do adjacent accesses. We want to access things which are close by. And as an operating system with a modern disk, our main mechanism for doing this is that hopefully things which are close by on the disk are going to have similar sector numbers. This is how the disk is going to number the sectors for us, is that sector 0, 1, and 2 are going to be close to each other physically, and sector 1000, 1001, 1002 are also going to be close physically, where by close physically I mean in the sense of having low seek time and low rotational latency to get between. So questions about these processing times? So here I'm showing you the disk access times, which are dependent on the physical layout of the disk. We also have a couple other components that come up. So this is not like what determines how fast we can access the disk. So one other thing which happens is we can ask for multiple things from the disk at once, and we might have to wait in line. Like, we're going to request, hey, read sector 1000, 1050, 1070, you know, the disk controller is going to do that in some order, and that means that we're going to have to wait for those reads to finish, which might be a little slower. And there's going to be some processing time for the disk controller and possibly the operating system to figure out what we're doing. But for the most part, these are, on typical workloads, the big things we want to worry about as far as making good use of the disk. So another thing about the disk is that some locations on the disk might be faster than others. I think this might vary with modern disk, but being closer to the edge might mean that you have less rotational latency to get to the same data, because you can store things less densely over here. And I say maybe because some disks might lay out things with different densities at different parts of the disk, so that might not be always true. Okay. So I mentioned that we're going to know where things are close by sector numbers. And historically, things were different. Historically, the OS actually like told the disk, hey, I want to use cylinder X, track X, sector X. But this is not how modern disks work anymore. They just decided that it's not actually useful because hard drive makers want to do other things with how they lay out their hard drives. They want to have more options. So typically, now we just have single sector numbers, where the pattern is low sector numbers are typically close to the center of the disk. That's the hopefully faster part. And adjacent are typically adjacent on disk. And as you go up, you get towards the end of the disk. And the disk controller is going to actually decide on the mapping, so it's going to have a lot of leeway as far as what it decides to do if you say read sector 10. So we have these sector numbers, and the way that this controller works typically is that it's going to just send a bunch of requests saying, I want to read this, write this. And for each of them, it's going to give the sector numbers it wants to read or write, the place it wants the data to be put in memory, typically we'll use DMA. And there will be a queue of pending requests. And the OS, if it wants to, can say, hey, write this, then write this. But if it doesn't, the disk controller is just going to decide what order to do them in. And you might say, why would I want the disk controller to decide that? Well, the disk controller knows where things are physically on the disk, so it can order that in a way which makes sense based on avoiding moving the disk arm too much and so on. Okay. And we'll talk about that a bit later. So I've talked sort of about the interface for disk and what they physically look like. And something to observe is that disks are very intricate things. They have actual, we saw here, moving parts. And these are actually very, very small, sensitive moving parts. And they're writing data magnetically at a very, very tiny scale. And this could possibly not work. And in fact, let's see. So show of hands, who has experienced a hard disk failing? Yeah. So they fail relatively often. And there's like empirical data for this. So where did I get? Yeah. So Google in 2007, they did a study on the disk they were using in their data centers, which were probably a little more heavily utilized than yours. And they discovered that they had a 1.7 to 8.6% annualized failure rate. That means for a given disk, you had a chance between in that range of it failing within a year. In any given year. The rate varied with age, with model, and by failure here, they mean the disk needs to be replaced. So this is like actual failure. So not great reliability, but manageable. I would note that they were using cheap disks. More expensive disks might be more reliable. But the disk fail, like data stops being recorded magnetically, or there's some mechanical failure. But even the working disks have something kind of like a failure. So they have this thing known as reallocated sectors. So 9% of their disks have this thing known as reallocated sectors. And that meant that part of the disk failed, but the disk controller hid this from you. It said, usually I'd put sector 0 at this point, but that's not working anymore. That part of the disk is physically broken. So I'm going to put it somewhere else and just fix that for you. And this is something modern disk controllers do. They expect that part of the disk is going to become bad, and they work around it. So they have some special part of the disk, or maybe some flash memory or something, where they track, where are we putting these bad parts of the disk? And they remap it, use a different part, and they do that translation whenever the OS is requesting to read or write particular sectors. So this is one thing they do to deal with, you know, that recording data at a micrometer scale magnetically is not actually super reliable. So there's other things they do to deal with that, is that because it's not super reliable, this is what they're doing after they do what are known as error detecting and correcting codes. So error detecting codes are like you have a hash, you know, something, a checksum. Who's seen checksums? Like half people. So you have some redundancy to indicate, you know, so you can figure out, did this data change? That's an error detecting code. So the idea of that is that if the bits like get damaged, they'll know, and the OS and the disk will, instead of saying, giving you bogus data, will be able to tell you, oh, something was broken with that. And I know because like the hash disagreed with what I expected, therefore I don't have the data for this sector, I'm sorry. But that's hopefully better than getting no data. They also do error correcting codes where they have basically extra copies in some format of the data to fix problems, but not like literal extra copies. They have some more compact form where they can deal with some amount of data being broken. you want details on this, 4434 should cover actually how these sort of mathematical ways of encoding data work, but this is something they're doing already, and in spite of that, they still need to remap sectors. No. This is after having redundancy in how they record the information for a sector. And the important thing about this for the operating system is that the way disks fail is not that they just randomly have the wrong data, it's that they tell you, I don't know, sorry, that sector you wrote a while ago don't have it anymore. And that's why, and they can do that because they already do this error detecting codes. They have some redundancy to figure out, do I not have the right data? Okay. So the question is, does the disk tell the OS that there's less space available to use? So generally, the way sector remapping works is at disk manufacture time, they just reserve a fixed amount of extra space that they never tell the OS exists. And if that runs out, the disk fails. That's usually, I think, what disk manufacturers do. There are interfaces. One is known as SMART, which is an acronym for something, where the disk will tell you about whether it's likely to fail. And one of the things that looks at is it can give you access to counters of like, how many sectors have I remapped? How many do I have left? But the format of that depends extremely on like exactly what manufacturer and model of disk you have. Okay. Other questions? Okay. So now we've talked about failure, let's go back to what I mentioned earlier about queuing requests and that we might order them. So we have queues of requests, and this is both in the controller. We mentioned the controller has a list of active requests. The OS might also have a list of requests because a bunch of programs are trying to read. It hasn't sent them all to the disk controller yet. And we know that the disk is faster for adjacent or close by reads or writes. So there's this thing we might called scheduling of the disk, where we need to decide, we have this list of things to do, which one do we do first? So for the OS, what to request from the disk next? For the disk controller, it has a list of requests, which one do I do next? And this is another scheduling problem, but it's a bit different than sort of our processor scheduling one, because we have to manage seek time. And seek time depends on which two requests we're doing next to each other. And there are conflicting goals here. So one goal would be to minimize seek time. That's something we want to do. And what would that look like? So here I have a picture. Let's say that this is the outside, this is the inside of the disk, and the yellow marks represent where we're reading from the disk, and the blue squiggly lines represent movement of the disk head physically over the disk. So short of seek time first, we're going to say, okay, I finished this. I'm going to go to the closest thing that is already requested, which is this one, not this one, which is further away. And I don't know about these yet because they haven't been queued yet. They aren't in the list. So I go here, and then I say I could go after this. I can go here, or here, or here, or here. But this one is closer, so I'm going to go up here to minimize my seek time. I'm going to do as little seeking as possible and just keep doing that, just taking the request which does the least seeking. So, this makes sense? Question? Yeah.
So for process scheduling, you have like kind of the idea of starvation.
Yeah.
It would get to it, would this also be here?
Yes. And you might notice that these two requests at the bottom are basically starved. And if we had more requests come in up here, we would never get to that. So this is one of the big problems with actually trying to minimize seek time, is that, sure, you minimize seek time, but now you have these requests which are sitting around waiting potentially forever. And it's probably worse than processor starvations because it's probably surprising that these like disk requests are different because you don't really know where things are on the disk. You don't know, it's on the other side of the disk, therefore it waits forever. Like that doesn't make sense for you as much as saying, you're a batch program, you're waiting forever because there's interactive stuff. Like that kind of makes sense to you as a programmer, probably. Okay, so we have starvation. So if you want to avoid starvation, we're going to want a different algorithm. And we'll talk about that later. So something to note here is I'm only showing minimizing seek time. On a real disk, we also have rotational latency. So there's a modification of this, which I'm not going to talk about in detail, where you also take that into account, known as shortest positioning time first. And I'm just going to ignore rotational latency throughout today as far as scheduling, because it's something you need to worry about in the real world, but we're not going to be implementing disk controller schedulers. So you can look up the details if you need to do that. So we want to not starve requests, but we still want to like keep seek time low. We don't want to just do the request in order, which would be the most fair thing. So one idea is that we can just go in a particular direction. So here, what I'm doing is I'm saying I'm going to go this way on the disk, and then I'm going to switch to this way and take everything I cross as I go, and this avoids starvation because I know I'm always going to just sweep up and down, that there's some bounded amount of time until I get to you. And it still achieves not horrible seek times because we're doing things in order, so we're not ever like backtracking. So in that sense, we're not like getting worse seek time than we need to. And this is known as scan, or sometimes look. It's a way of ordering the requests we have. So another possibility is something known as circular scan. And here, rather than going in one direction and then the other, we say we're always going to go, in this case, from the outside to the inside of the disk. And when we don't have anything more further inside, we go back all the way to the outside and then go back. This has the advantage of being more fair. And that's not completely obvious. Like, why would this be unfair? And the reason is that things in the middle here get serviced more quickly than things in the edges. And this avoids that problem. The other thing about this approach is that the disk might have a fast way of resetting the head to the outside. That's something you might be able to do physically. So you might be able to make that seek time not so bad by just having some fast, like, get the head all the way to the edge of the disk operation in the physical hardware. So those are sort of basic algorithms. Oh, also something to note, I mentioned I used the name scan for the algorithm which went up and down. Another name for that algorithm is an elevator algorithm. That might help you remember what it's doing. It's the elevator up and down, and it's the same scheduling algorithm used for deciding what floor an elevator goes to, probably. Okay, so questions about these disk scheduling algorithms? Okay, so that's disk scheduling. Okay, so this one of the things the controller needs to do, it needs to take into account where the data is on the disk and decide which of the many requests I have to do it. Controllers also do some other stuff which might be surprising to you. So we talked about the operating system caches data on disk and memory. Turns out that the controller often also caches data on disk in its own memory. It has its own DRAM cache for data on disk, which it uses to satisfy the OS's request to read from the disk. So sometimes they'll actually read from a DRAM cache on the controller. And this is one way disk manufacturers make their disks faster. Also, this controller could hold data waiting to be written, so it can like take the request from the OS to write something and put it in that cache and say, I'm ready, I can keep going, you can give me more requests. Okay. So the big thing we're going to take away from this is that because of how this works, file systems can take advantage of that by, well, doing contiguous writes, reads or writes, or nearby reads or writes, that we want to have things not skip all over the disk. We want to actually keep things together. So for example, if you have a big file, you want it all in the same part of the disk. You don't want it scattered all around the disk, because that's going to be a lot of seek time, and it's going to be slower to read that big file. And another thing is that we can start lots of reads and writes at once. And so this is a problem with the FAT structure that, you know, in FAT, like, we read one thing to read the next thing. We want to avoid that. That we can do reads and writes in parallel, and that's an efficient thing. And we want to store, like, the things we need to read all together, ideally. Okay. So that's on disk. So I mentioned that probably a more dominant technology for new machines these days is solid-state disks. So let's talk a bit about how solid-state disks work. Solid-state disks don't use physically spinning disks and moving arms, which makes them possibly more reliable. Instead, they have some controller, which is often much more sophisticated than a disk controller, often has like a real CPU, like something of the grade you might have on your cell phone, that's connected to a bunch of what are known as flash chips, so NAND flash most typically, usually an array of these, and these store data electrically, usually with basically capacitors. And the controller acts with these. And the way these flash chips work, so they're electrical, so there's no seek time, no rotational latency, we can avoid that, but they still have some constraints. So typically, reading from one of those chips, you have to read a whole, what is called a page, and often that's like 4 kilobytes or 16 kilobytes, and that's the minimum unit you can read from the chips, that if you're gonna read one part, you know, one byte, you're gonna read the whole 4K around it. And these are typically have these erasing operation that's separate from the writing operation. So you erase part of the flash, and then you can write to that erased part of the flash. And if you want to write to it again, you need to erase it first. So erasing clears it, sets it up so you can write to it, then you can write to it piecemeal, at least in like page by page or something like that. But then if you want to overwrite that, you need to erase it again. And erasing is typically done in what are called erasure blocks, which are often pretty big, usually bigger than a page, like 256K to maybe megabytes. And that is the only unit you can erase things in. You have to erase like a whole megabyte. You can't erase smaller portions to overwrite them. And there's usually a limit on how many times you can erase a block. So often it's like order tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of times. And if you do it more than that, it will start electrically failing to hold data. So SSDs take this flash interface and turn it into something which looks like a hard disk. So there's a bunch of things we need to do. First, we need to work in sectors, which are typically smaller than pages, but maybe not. And we need to want to write sectors at a time, even though the erasure blocks are much bigger. That means that we can't actually physically overwrite that, so we're going to need to emulate that. And we also need to handle queuing. So the big thing is we want to hide those erasure blocks. So the typical mechanism a solid-state disk will use is something known as block remapping, that when you want to overwrite something, rather than overwriting it immediately, which it can't do because it would need to overwrite everything that's stored around it, it's going to move it to a new location, and it's going to keep track of where it's moved to. So it's going to keep track of this big mapping of, for everything the OS knows about, where is it actually in the flash? We also need to hide the limit on the number of erases. So think of something like a big directory that you keep adding and removing files from. That gets written to a lot of times, and it's one location on a disk. For a hard drive, that isn't so much a problem. We can overwrite that location many times, and it doesn't dramatically affect the failure rate. But for flash, it would dramatically increase our failure rate because we have this limit of like order 10,000 or 100,000 writes that we can do before it's going to fail. And you can imagine that, yeah, you might update a directory 10,000 times over a week if like you have a program writing a temp file there, removing it, writing a new temp file there. So how do we avoid that? Well, as part of this block remapping, we're gonna spread the load out over the entire flash. So each part is used evenly, even though the OS thinks it's writing to the same part of the solid state disk over and over again. That's actually going to write all across all the flash chips, or approximately. So questions on these general goals and like the high level strategy? Okay, so let's go in like a little more detail of the way this works. So typically these SSDs will have what they often call a flash translation layer that takes the sector numbers the OS knows about and translates them to flash locations. I've marked the sector numbers the OS knows about as logical sectors, and the ones the flash knows about as physical sectors. And this flash translation layer is going to keep track of the erasure blocks of the flash, each of which will be multiple pages that it can read or write at once. And it's going to have, some of them are going to contain some data that's like the OS can actually read, and some unused data. And it's unused because it's got rewritten elsewhere. And one of them is going to be being written, and we have one here that's erased and is going to be the next place we start writing data to. So when the OS does a read, this translation layer looks up in this table, oh, where did I put sector 31? It's in 74. I'm actually going to read from over here and give that to the OS. When the OS does a write, what we're going to do is we're going to say, okay, you're trying to write. I'm going to actually move that write to the end of where I'm writing, which means I'm going to unmap the thing up here, which is where it originally was. So that makes sense. So we just update that, and now we have a little bit of unused space up here that we didn't have before. So a problem is that eventually we're going to keep writing, and we're going to copy this data up here, and we're going to run out of space, and we want to erase this block over here to make room to keep on going. And the way we'll do that is we'll say, okay, I want to make more space, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to take all the stuff in this erasure block that is not inactive, and I'm going to copy it to the end of where I'm writing. So update some mappings for that. And then, by doing that, now I freed up this block so I can erase it to write more stuff later. And this is known as garbage collection. This is how we free up more space, so we freed up some extra space to write. And namely, we freed up space because we know we have these gray regions here which weren't used. And now we can effectively reuse that space later on. Yes?
Could you go over again how a space becomes gray?
Space becomes free?
Yeah.
So in the case here, where I'm writing originally, this was sector 32 was 75, which is somewhere right here. So as part of writing the value here, we're going to mark this becomes, is now unused, and this is now active data. So as we rewrite things, it becomes unused. Okay. So other questions? And so so basically the gray parts, we wrote something there and we overwrote it elsewhere in the flash, and that's why it's not available. And we copy things over so we have these big contiguous blocks of free data. And that's the basic way that a solid state disk will work. Okay. So the basic algorithm is that we have this mapping, and on write we always choose a new location. And eventually we do this garbage collection where we copy the data to a contiguous place so we can take the free spaces and use that space for other things. So we can erase a whole block. After we copy, that whole block is unused and we can erase it. And this is a very complicated thing, and a lot of why SSD performance varies. If you buy SSDs, it depends on what manufacturer you have, how fast it is and so on. And this is because there's a lot of choices to make here about like, where do you write things? When do you do the garbage collection? Do you like do things always in the same order? But this is something SSDs do. And this is why I said the controller in SSDs is often pretty complicated. They often have something that like might be a low-end cell phone grade processor in them to handle these operations. So SSDs are a lot faster than hard drives. For, you know, reason writes can be sub-millisecond because we aren't physically moving something over a platter. And also, contiguous blocks don't really matter. They're probably not contiguous in the flash anyways, because they're all that remapping. But there are some things we can know about performance. So writing to flash can be slower because it's a lot more complicated. We need to move things around, and if we need to do garbage collection, if we need to copy data that we aren't even writing right now, that's old, to a new location, that's extra work we need to do that kind of amplifies our writes and means there's more effort to like free up erasure blocks. And this can also depend a lot on like whether the controller like does things like, does it like free up the blocks in advance, how far in advance, and so on. Okay, so questions about SSD performance? So one other thing to know about SSDs. So I said SSDs imitate hard drives, but they have like added a few operations that are like only make sense for SSDs. And one operation that operating systems have started to take advantage of is called trim, which is to say, I'm not using this sector anymore, just get rid of it. And this is helpful for the SSD because the SSD, rather than keeping track of the old data that was written there, it can just forget about it from its block map. So this is an example of how the operating system can take advantage of how the SSD actually works. Okay. So we talked about how solid state disks work. I'd like to know for the future, since you're hopefully going to graduate and we will continue making new technologies for storage, that there are emerging technologies which are generally called non-volatile memories, which are slower than normal memory, dynamic random access memory. That's what a quote-unquote normal memory chip you would buy for a desktop or laptop is, and faster than SSDs, and have a read and write interface that is kind of more similar to a memory, like main memory, than to an SSD, but have capacities which are larger than DRAM, like kind of in the middle of SSDs and DRAM. And this might be where we're going as far as storage is later. We might have like something which is, you know, one of these which is 128 gigs in a laptop that's persistent but looks like memory and not like a hard drive. And the future, hard to say how far off it is because these things have been anticipated for a while. And people probably thought they were 5 years off 5 years ago, and we're not correct, but this is definitely something that's like slowly being prototyped and likely to happen. And it's a big challenge for operating systems because all the file systems we'll talk about don't really make sense for a RAM-like interface. I'm going to do something very different for that, and it's not clear what it should be. Okay, so let's talk about older file systems, though. We'll talk about our hard disk file systems. And I'll start by talking about the file system that XV6 uses. And I'm going to talk about that because it's typical of the whole class of file system that Unix-like OS do. And it does some things better than FAT does. It handles reading contiguously better than FAT. It's better at like keeping things together and making it so you could read them. It's better at handling crashes. And it uses a different organization of the data about files than FAT does, which is typically what Unix-like operating systems have done. So here's what the layout of the XV6 disk looks like. And I'll talk about each of these components because there's some terms you probably don't know, like inode. What is that? We'll talk about that. Superblock, so on. So first we have this thing labeled the superblock. And the superblock is the XV6 disk's header. So it's the exact same purpose as the fat header. It tells you things like how much space is in the file system, how many data blocks are there, how many inodes, which we'll talk about what those are there, but how big is this area of the disk. It tells you like what the layout of the disk is, just like for fat, the header told us where the fats were, how big they were, and so on. That information's in the what XV6 calls the super block, which is basically its header. You may say, there's some things I was expecting that aren't here, like we don't have the block size, which is the same as the cluster size. That's just hard-coded. That's why they don't have it in the header. So then we have this inode array. So XV6 has an array of file information. And this is a fixed-sized array. The size is chosen when the disk is created, or set up, formatted. And for every file, we have this little struct, which has the type of the file. Is it a directory, a normal file, or a device file? We have, for device files, the number of the device. This is the lookup into that table. And we have the size of the file. So remember that from V6. We also have this number of links. I'll talk about what that means later. And we have an array of data block addresses, of where the data for the file is. So rather than a linked list, we have an array of the addresses of the data of the file. You might have some complaints of like, how big a file can we store? We'll get to that later, but yes, it's not as big as that. And you might also notice that we seem to be missing file names. We don't have file names here. We just have an index, and we don't have a name. So where are the names? And the answer for that is the same as in FAT. They're going to be in the directories, and we'll see that later. But notice that unlike FAT, we've stored sort of our file information all in one place for a particular file. Everything but the name of the file is stored all together, unlike FAT, where it's stored with the directory. We have a dedicated place for each file in this case. So this inode refers to data blocks which are in the data block section. So we also need a way of finding free space on the disk, and that's what this free block map is. So this is an array of bits where it's 1 if the data block is available, 0 otherwise. And this is how we find free space to put files. So it still has the linear search problem you might not have liked with FAT, but at least we're searching a list of bits and not a list of, you know, bigger numbers to find it. So it might be a little better. And notably, this makes it easier to allocate contiguous files because we can easily find contiguous ones in here relative to something like the FAT. Like, it's pretty easy to look for that, kind of. You might say, we have a list of free data blocks. What about free inodes? The solution XV6 uses is that this type variable will be 0 if the inode is free. So we want to allocate an inode. We want to store information for a file. We'll scan the inode array for one with type equals 0 and replace that with type equals file or directory. This is the high-level layout. And I said we had inodes, but the inodes don't have names. So the names are going to be in our directory entry. So here's what the directory entry for XV6 looks like. So in FAT, we had all our information about the file in the directory entry. Here instead, we just have a pointer to the inode in the terms of its index in that array and the name. And that's it. And this is typically what Unix-like systems do to actually implement directories. They don't actually store all the information about the file in the directory. They just store its index and its name. And each of these directory entries is commonly referred to as a hard link. And as we'll see later, something that XV6 and Unix allows is you can have multiple hard links to the same file. And that's what this n link value is for. It's tracking how many links are there to the file, how many directory entries refer to this file. So we have some other things, so we have searching for a new IO in a data block. X36 always takes the first one that's free. With FAT, I didn't tell you what to do because, well, the file system layout doesn't say you have to do this, but this is what X36 chose to do because it's the simplest thing. But you could imagine you could do better. So let's look at XV6 versus FAT. So I mentioned we have this, there's a log I skipped over. We'll talk about that in a future lecture, but that supports reliability. So FAT is very bad if like something breaks. Like it's not clear what happens. XV6 has much better support for that, which we'll talk about later. The block map is maybe easier. And something notable as far as thinking about disk performance is that our information about file size and type is held with the block locations. So this means that we don't need to look at two different places on the disk to find out all the information about a file, which we have to do with FAT. With FAT, we read the directory entry, then we read all over the FAT file allocation table to figure out where the file is. Here, we get the number, we read the inode, we have everything we need to read the file, because all the block numbers are there. We don't need to search around the FAT to find them. Okay, so let's talk about some things which might seem to be bad. So one thing that seems to be a problem that I showed you is, what about big files? How do we deal with a big file? I have an array of whatever. I have an array of n direct plus 1, whatever that number is, block numbers. And you're either going to say, well, either you're wasting a ton of space in this inode array, or I can't store very big files. But it's not so bad. So what XV6 does is it divides the array of blocks. It actually has two types of blocks. So the first 12 entries in the array are what are known as direct blocks. And they point to a data block. But the last one, it isn't a direct block. It points to a block. A block of more block numbers. So we have the second part of the array is extended there. So in this way, we have room for, in this case, this is 512 bytes divided by 2 bytes per block number. So we have 256 extra block numbers. So we're not limited to 12 blocks in our file. We can have 256 plus, not limited to 13, we're going to have 256 plus 12. And only for large files do we store this extra block of block numbers, so we aren't wasting space all the time to support having that large files. So with 512 byte blocks, we have this optional block of 256 extra block numbers. So we can store about 6K if we don't use any extra blocks to store block numbers. And if we do, we can store an extra 256K. And if we add those together, we get our maximum file size, which is not as bad as it might have appeared, but still not great. So questions on this scheme? Yeah. Okay. And this scheme is used by real OSs. So here's the Linux inode structure, which is actually pretty similar to what XV6 does. So it has some things XV6 doesn't have, and some things it does. So it has the type information that's in this mode variable. So is it a file or directory and so on? It has some extra metadata that XV6 doesn't track, like users that own the file, access times, modification times, some extra data we might want to keep track of. And it has an array of block pointers, but it's a little more flexible than what XV6 does. So the Linux extended 2 array of block pointers here, it has 15 entries, and those are block pointers, and it has more indirection. So one of these, the 13th one, points to a block containing more block numbers, but the one after that points to a block containing block numbers which contain more block numbers, so what is known as a double indirect block. So we have our direct pointers. So for small files, this is all we use. For bigger files, we might use this indirect pointer, which points to another block of more block numbers. But if that's not enough, we have this double indirect pointer, where we have two layers. And if that's still not enough, we have a triple indirect pointer, and usually we're satisfied there. Because it turns out that this can hold a lot of space. So questions about this idea here? Okay. So this is what Linux's extended to file system does for storing the location of the file data. So let's, you know, so 12 direct pointers, one indirect, one direct, one double indirect, and one triple indirect. Yeah?
Are the indirects pointing to contiguous memory, or can you, once you've gotten a couple levels down, can you basically mix and match?
So the question is, are these pointing to contiguous memory? It is not guaranteed that anything is pointing to contiguous at all, because each of the block pointers are pointing to a single block with no guarantees on what's next to them. Now, for performance, we hope that the data blocks of the file are close to each other. But there's no guarantee of that. They could, all these blocks could be scattered all over the disk randomly. And that's everything I have as a picture here, as a little box here. But hopefully that doesn't happen, but it might. Other questions? So since questions, let's have an exercise. So let's say I have 1 kilobyte blocks. How big can a file be? And let's say I have 1 kilobyte blocks and the block pointers are, let's say, 4 bytes. I'll give you, I would need paper. Or a calculator or something. We can start with okay, so I want to go over, I guess I don't have enough time. So the procedure I use for this, so for the direct pointers, each one points to 1 kilobyte, so that's 12K. For the indirect pointer, it points to 1 kilobyte of pointers, so that's 1k divided by 4, which is 256, assuming I didn't mess up my math. So that points to 256k via one layer of indirection. With two layers of indirection, we have 256 pointers in the thing we point to first, each of which point to another 256k. So we have 256 times 256k. And for the triple indirect, we have 256 times 256 times 256k. So this gets pretty big. And this is where we'll finish up this time. Next time we'll pick up on like why we want to use this scheme and also talk about some alternatives. And other file system issues.